welcome, Junkions, to a particularly shook-up episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Don't drink that milkshake. I am, of course, your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce.
He's making his own homemade Orange Julius.
Yeah, whatever the fuck that's about. It's C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And you, I was going to say, and he's in yet a third movie away from me, so, but we'll get into that as we talk about this week's movie.
Yeah, we will.
Which I'm super excited to talk about.
Movies.
Which, by the way, is going to be our last movie of the summer of 88, and what a fucking way to go out. I am dazzled by this movie. I don't think there's another way to put it.
This is, yeah, we had a couple other movies on the docket, and then we just kind of were like, I don't know. That just didn't live up, or the politics of it were just a little too weird.
Or the idea of a child fucking a grown woman seemed a little odd to us.
30 years later, that movie
has a big problem.
Has a big problem that I think we should probably not talk about.
Hey, speaking of big problems, we have 4 years worth of episodes. 200 episodes prior to this one.
Years worth, but isn't it? Aren't we actually like 5 years in?
We're going into our fifth year, I think, because I believe we started in 2014. So it's a hell of a long time, no matter how you slice it.
Sure wasn't 2013?
I am not, I don't know. Because we've been doing so much of this, I couldn't possibly tell you for certain.
I have no idea when we started this.
But you can find out for yourself by going to our back catalog on iTunes as well as Blog Talk Radio. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And hey, if you really like the show.
I mean really like the show.
If you like the show more than James Glickenhaus likes his own movies and wants to feature them in his other movies, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content that only you get to hear, and it's just our way of saying thank you for financially supporting this insane project. And hey, speaking of insane, have we got a fucking movie for you this week?
Oh boy. I think movie might be a stretch of the word.
Movies. Movies kind of congeals the ratatouille of films, where they take three different movies and just kind of throw them into a casserole dish. And what comes out is the Bugnuts Insane film that I discovered by accident and was one of my favorite, is already one of my favorite filmic discoveries of this year. And I am talking, of course, about Shakedown.
Oh boy, Shakedown.
One thing I promise not to do in this courtroom is to pretend to you that I am representing Snow White for a client.
An overworked lawyer.
Once upon a time, all I plan to do is play the tennis sax forever.
An undercover cop.
This gun is clean. No serial numbers.
They're up against a city where the bad guys have taken over.
My client will make bail.
And the good guys are the worst of all.
You cops, you're the best that money can buy.
$50K a month in evidence disappears.
Plan on taking down an army?
I don't know yet.
Just the way I like it.
You better watch out.
I can roll with anything you put out, buddy.
Who are you looking for? Excuse me
while I kiss this guy. Peter Weller.
You're gonna miss me when I'm gone, babe.
Sam Elliott.
Oh, I know what you're thinking. I'm old and slow.
Shakedown. Whatever you do, don't call the cops.
This is a movie that, when we pitch it to you, you're going to say, how the hell did I not know this movie existed?
Yes. It seems like a movie that was written by Junk Food Cinema Mad Libs.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, in terms of actors who are in it and
things that happen in it.
Character actors, structural things. Yeah, this sounds like it's like this is, I find it very interesting that we paired this with Action Jackson. Because Action Jackson is what happens when you go into a movie knowing exactly what it is. And then you just kind of, you stick the landing.
Yeah.
This is what happens when you think you know what you're making, but you're actually making something completely different. And then it just kind of goes off the rails. And then just as you're bringing it back in on the rails, it goes way off the rails, both literally and figuratively.
There is literally a scene of a roller coaster going off the rails.
Yeah, as Joe Bob Briggs would say, this movie contains roller coaster foo. And it is... This is a movie that the sum of the parts is better than the whole. Let's just lay that out.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that entirely, but there was something about the way this movie is stitched together and the final product that comes off the slab of this Dr. Frankenstein's lab that spoke directly to my greasy heart. Like, I love this movie, and I love how fucking weird it is. I love all of the things it reaches for, even if it doesn't quite grasp, and all of the things it hits accidentally by not even trying.
I also love that it's made by the writer-director of The Astrologer.
Yeah, James Glickenhaus is a weird, weird fucking filmmaker.
He's a very weird filmmaker who directed films for 20 years, and this is the most watchable.
This is his most polished movie.
This is his most polished movie.
This is an exploitation filmmaker who... I don't think it is any accident whatsoever that one of the characters in this movie seemingly lives in a 42nd Street theater, which you want to talk about living. Like, if I were alive, I was technically alive in 1988, but if I were living in the golden age of 42nd Street, that is where I want to be. I want to be living in a fucking 42nd Street theater, which, by the way, is showing The Soldier, which is another of his films. But James Glickenhaus is a guy who is known for making really hyper-violent exploitation movies.
That's most of them not good.
And most of them very not good. Now, I'm not gonna defend those.
I have a love for The Exterminator.
Yeah.
It's not good. No. I love The Exterminator 2 better because it has a supreme fucking awesome goddamn score to it that you could just sit and listen to the score and it feels like every awesome cheesy movie from 1982 ever. But he made The Astrologer. Now we need to take a sidebar.
Sidebar! 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 There it is.
About The Astrologer. So The Astrologer is probably one of the most deranged, fucked up movies you will ever see in your life. Like, it is just, it is something that the Alamo Drafthouse dug out. They got a hold of it through AGFA, the American Film Genre Archive, which, by the way, is one of the greatest things on the planet. For those of you who are unfamiliar with it, they just collect and protect old films that are abandoned films, especially films that don't have a home. Most studios have places, archives, where they keep prints of their old movies. But a lot of these genre films that were made independently and were taken on the regional circuits back in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, these films don't have real homes. And so AGFA finds, tracks down, and protects these films and shows them and rents them out and maintains them. And here in Austin, if you were or are a film critic, the draft house usually will give you a house on your birthday to show a film and will give you access to AGFA. And that's, many of you have heard me talk about some of the crazy stuff that I've pulled out from the past. One of their pickups in recent years was a film called The Astrologer. And The Astrologer is Glickenhaus going nuts on screen. Just, it is a madhouse of a fucking movie. It makes not a lick of goddamn sense.
And it should be pointed out, this was the first film that he ever wrote and directed. It was his
and starred in.
His entry into the business is The Astrologer, and he has a career after that. That is nothing short of miraculous.
It's literally one of the worst movies ever made, but it is one of those worst movies ever made that you can't take your eyes off of because it's a movie that starts out as like diamond heists in the jungle, going on the run and turning into a guy becoming a highfalutin astrologer and watching his life rise up and then collapse. And it's like, what the fuck is this movie? Every scene seems like it's in a completely different fucking movie. But it's like this weird fever dream that you can't stop watching and has this amazing bullshit dialogue in it. And he took that fever dream mentality and kept making movies for 20 years after, despite the fact. And Shakedown is the result of that. So let's get back in.
I am so disappointed, by the way, that Beverly Hills Cop 2 claimed the song Shakedown from Bob Seger as a soundtrack song, because every time I watch this movie, that's the song that's playing in my head as I watch it.
It should be Shakedown.
And it makes it like 100 times better. Like, this is a movie. No, these are movies.
These are movies.
I think we need to describe Shakedown as plural.
Yeah, because we have an argument here at Junk Food HQ between whether this is two different movies or three.
Yes, we are splitting hairs with the guy, me, who is rapidly losing his hair. I should really stop doing that. But yeah, it's the least combative argument you can have. Is Shakedown two movies or three wrapped into one?
So what are the two movies that it definitely is?
Now, in a traditional buddy cop film or in a buddy movie, the two protagonists are different from each other, but both working within, you could say, the same fucking plot.
Not only the same plot, the same job. In a buddy cop movie,
yes,
you take two cops who don't belong together, you put them together on the same case, and then they are forced to work together. This is not that.
See, this is the thing. You do that when you're making an action film. When you're making a comedy, sometimes you put the cop with someone who's not a cop, and it like causes friction.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's a kid
hooch or a dog, cop and a half,
or
yes.
Or a psychic investigator.
Yes.
Or, you know, it's like, oh, why are we together? And then it turns out we're together because we're the only people who can solve this case.
No. That's not enough for Glickenhaus. Glickenhaus wants to do the comedy setup in an action drama. That's bug nuts in and of itself.
So before we get into this, let's talk about why this movie should even be on anyone's radar. There are two actors in this movie that when we lay out who's in this movie, you're going to be like, holy fuck, how have I not seen this movie? Because they are junk foodie as fuck.
The most junk foodie of junk food alums, I feel.
It is summer of... Imagine this. It is summer of 88, and you have the star of RoboCop and the greatest character actor from Roadhouse.
Yeah, Sam Elliott making his return to junk food cinema.
Sam Elliott playing a guy from Texas.
And by the way, Peter
Weller... Being a cop in Chicago?
By the way, I just want to point out Peter Weller's character in this movie is named Dalton. So throughout this whole fucking film, yet again, we hear Sam Elliott saying, "Well, Dalton..." And I'm like, okay, am I just watching a sequel to Roadhouse because I'm on board for it?
No, what it turns out is he's gotten hit in the head too many times. And he didn't die in Roadhouse as we thought he did. He just was drunk. And so now he's back and he's a cop.
Yeah.
And sleeping in a theater. And
It's definitely New York because they're going
to... It's New York, yeah.
They're going to 42nd Street.
It's like, Peter... And Peter Weller is...
Is a lawyer. So it is an undercover cop played by Sam Elliott and a public defending lawyer who's about to make the big jump to a corporate law firm thanks to the woman he's going to marry and her daddy's setting him up with a job.
Now, that's the thing, is you would think with the setup we just gave you, this movie is about Sam Elliott and we're going to follow Sam Elliott on a case and he's going to be interacting with this public defender. Oh, no.
No, it's not.
No, this movie is about a public defender in his last week who finds a case where he honestly believes the guy is innocent of this crime. It's a full Daredevil story, and I love that it's a Daredevil story.
It is a Daredevil story.
It is, because he acknowledges this guy is a shitty, shitty person. They even have that scene where they have it out, and he's like, don't you fucking talk to me about shit. You are a fucking pusher who sells... poison to fucking kids. Don't act like you have moral superiority here. His whole thing is he knows that, as we see in the beginning of the movie, this guy selling drugs in Central Park is approached by a dirty cop. The cop pulls out his gun and tries to kill the guy. The guy shoots in self-defense and murders the cop. So now all the dirty cops in New York, because it's the 80s and they're all still all dirty, as opposed to today, which is they're just... awful.
I was like, yeah, there's nothing but good apples now in that barrel. Thank God the 80s are over,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, if you ever want to hear a couple stories, hand me a beer and ask me about New York City Cops. And we'll talk about my feelings on New York City Cops.
Oh, I love that you're pretending it's just New York City Cops where this happens.
Oh, no. I mean, there's good cops and bad cops everywhere. We here in Austin have a very interesting history with police officers where we had a very, very terrible police force that we had a police chief come in and turn the entire force around. And now we've got a really great police force. I have stories about New York City Cops in particular I hate them.
Let's talk about this for just a second here, because we talk about how the setup reads comedy.
Not a lot of comedy in this movie.
Not a lot of comedy. The execution is mostly a stuntman's paradise because they really fucking go for it with the action sequences. And yet, Cargill, this movie posits a world where every cop, like, save maybe one or two, is filthy to the point that they, like, you might as well burn down the entire Central Police precinct because the guy at the front desk is dirty. Every cop that looks at you, every cop on the beat is going to surround you in what looks like something out of Maniac Cop and, like, do this intimidating dance. All the undercover detectives are dirty. It is like, Abel Ferreira is more optimistic about New York City than James Glickenhaus.
Except, who's the only clean cop in New York City, Brian?
The guy who falls, who lives at a fucking 42nd Street.
You're goddamn right. That is so. What this movie is about a district attorney who is trying to defend an innocent client, a client innocent of the crime, for which he has been accused, and has to occasionally bring Sam Elliott into the movie. I don't care that Sam Elliott is bigger on the cover than Peter Weller. I don't care because it's not his fucking movie and he's barely fucking in it. And he keeps showing up at the weirdest fucking times to show up into this movie.
Yeah.
So this
really does.
But he's in his own movie.
He is, and I want that movie. I want to live in that movie. I want the fucking Last Action Hero golden ticket. I want to go into his movie.
That movie is the movie you really want to be watching, but we keep going back to Peter Weller because apparently it's not just that Peter Weller is in his last week as a
public defender.
As a public, well, he's public defender, but he's legal aid.
Like, yes.
He's not just public defender. He's on the low rung of public defenders. He is a guy who spent 15 years of his life defending all the shitty people who can't afford a real lawyer.
And by the way, just to kind of segue into the cast of this movie, who do we learn all this information from as far as his position in the world of lawyers? Who's the guy who breaks this all down for
us? Dr. Cox!
Johnny C. McGinley!
C. McGinley showing up, being awesome, chewing up the scenery in every scene he's in.
If I have a complaint about this movie, not enough Johnny C.
Well, there's a lot of complaints about this movie, and they're all not enough fill in the blank. Let's be honest here.
Too much roller coaster.
No.
You don't think there's too much roller coaster in this movie?
Oh, God, no. We'll get there. We'll fucking get there, because, you know,
I haven't seen a roller coaster kill like this since Sudden Impact.
Dude, first of all, the roller coaster kill is the piece de resistance of the movie, second only to how batshit the last 5 minutes become.
I can't wait to get there either.
Like, what you have to understand about Shakedown, guys, is that what we are telling you about is one of those glorious movies that nobody else has really kind of plucked out and said, hey, by the way, this is really kind of glorious. This is a movie that me and my wife like to sit up and cuddle in bed and have a couple drinks and watch some of these movies together that she's never seen or sometimes that I've never seen. And she is the type of person who likes to, like, we hear unfiltered fiance turn unfiltered wife quite a bit. I don't talk about what my wife does a lot, and she is a hardcore film lover, but every once in a while, she has a lot more sensitive bullshit detector than I do. Mm-hmm. And she'll have that moment where she's like, wait, no, what is this? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Why are they doing that? And she'll have that thing where she'll make me pause it so she can go on a 5-minute rant about, like, go full Joe Bob, where she'll just stop the movie and be like, I don't understand this. I have questions.
Yeah.
And she'll ask me, like, why is the character doing this? This is the dumbest thing. And I'm that asshole who sits there and goes, well, I don't know. I'm going to side with the director and the screenwriter on this, and maybe this is what they're intending. We haven't gotten to this part of the movie yet. Maybe we're going to find out that this means something. I don't know. This is the movie where I just, about 20 minutes in, I'm like, this is not a fucking movie. what is this movie? And an hour in, I'm like, what the fuck is this movie? I have no idea what this movie is. Like, what is it trying? Like, why is Sam Elliott on the cover? He's not in this movie. Like, he shows up occasionally and he's always drinking and he's awesome. But what is this? And this was that movie that was just like, it was testing me.
And just to reiterate, the most polished movie of James Glickenhaus's oeuvre.
And then we get to the roller coaster scene, at which all of a sudden I sit up and I just look at my wife and go, fuck it, I'm in.
Like, yeah.
I'm fucking in.
Yeah.
So let's just lay that out and tell you why you need to see this movie. Because there is a scene in which the villain of this movie.
Yeah, who is played by Huggy Bear himself.
Yes.
Which is one of, like, by the way, I need to tick off a few things, because I talk about this a lot, but this movie ticks off a lot of boxes for me. Not the least of which being, I love, 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 love movies that show us 70s and 80s 42nd Street and all of the movies that are on the marquees, and holy fucking shit.
Oh, yeah.
This fucking movie was, and all the movies on the marquees.
It was shot in 1987.
And you can clearly tell.
Because the marquee has the hidden.
The fucking marquees are our lineup from last summer.
Yes.
It's the hidden Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors. At one point, there's one for Death Wish 4 The Crackdown. And I'm just looking at all these movies like, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit. There was a time when all these movies were playing at the exact same fucking time.
Yeah, it was called
time.
My Childhood.
Prince of Darkness. Awesome. Prince of Darkness is on one of the marquees.
Yeah.
I had such a nerd boner just watching him cruise down the street under these marquees.
Yeah. Glickenhaus is clearly in love with movies in this movie.
Including his own, because the theater where Sam Elliott is living, again, he's living in a fucking theater. Like, he literally walks into the bathroom
to brush his teeth.
Opens the circuit breaker, and he's got a little cup with his toothbrush and his toothpaste. He fucking lives at this theater. It's incredible. It's like everything I want to be when I grow up. And as he's just cruising down the street, he's just walking under marquees, and the theater he's in is a double feature of The Exterminator and The Soldier. And it's like, oh, it's the Glickenhaus Theater.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, the Glickenhaus Picture House. So the villain of this movie hires the other villain of this movie, because there's actually two villains of this movie, because we need a villain for each movie.
Really, there should be three villains.
So we have the drug dealer, who is the head drug dealer in Sam Elliott verse, and then the chief dirty cop, because all of the dirty cops are working under a big boss dirty cop, clearly. Oh,
Sergeant Hockey Hair.
Yeah, Sergeant Hockey Hair, who spits out casual racism nobody's business.
Oh my God.
Like, this movie, when we meet this villain, he not only is racist as fuck, but he's homophobic as fuck. Like, he's like everything that in the 80s was like, this is what I'm going to be a tough guy. That everything in our world is like, oh God, we know who you voted for. Holy shit. Like, you are an awful human being.
He makes Clancy Brown and Shawshank Redemption look downright progressive. Let's put it that way.
And so he, the dirty cop, hires the villain to go after and kill one of the cops.
So I guess we should. So the through plot. I will say it's the through
plot. We already got the through plot. No.
Because what it is that every cop is dirty, and, you know, we talked about the fact that there is a dirty cop that gets murdered by a drug dealer, and that's the world of Peter Weller. Now, the other part of this is that Sam Elliott, who is referred to as a blue jean cop, an undercover plainclothes detective.
No, he's not a blue jean cop.
Well, he's part of that crew.
Well, he's an undercover detective, but they actually set aside what a blue jean cop is. Because that's a phrase they use.
But he literally runs with the blue jean cops. Like, at one point, they're raiding Huggy Bear's, I'm just going to call him Huggy Bear, Huggy Bear's establishment, and he literally shows up, like, to clock in for work. So you can split thread counts all you want, but I mean, he's a blue jean cop.
I love how Glickenhaus actually spends 5 minutes setting up why he's got boobs in his movie. Like, he actually sets up this whole thing of this girl trying to get a fix so that she has to end up selling herself to the drug dealer for the fix, so that when the cops come in and she pops out of bed with a dude and we get boobs, it's like, oh, that's part of the story, and not just random boobs.
Yeah, because the last thing we want to think is that Glickenhaus is just putting things in here for exploitation value.
Yeah, exactly.
Far be it from James Glickenhaus to do something like that. By the way, the guy that they throw out of that bed lands dick first on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
That might be the most painful looking stunt in this whole movie. Because he is up in the air and then lands dick first on that floor. That made me very uncomfortable. So they raid, but then all of a sudden the money disappears from this raid. Where did the evidence get logged? We're not sure. David Provol, great character actor, is the guy working the evidence locker who's like, I don't know, my key doesn't work. Oh, I got
logged. He's a guy who, like, he's always a really interesting character actor. This is the first time he's been in a movie where I've wanted to punch him in the face every time he's in the... Like, he is so detestable in this, and deliberately so. Not like, I fucking hate this guy. Here's a character actor I love, and the minute he opens his mouth, you're like, oh, fuck this guy.
And he's good at that.
Fuck this guy.
David Provol's very good at that, because when he finally got murdered on The Sopranos, I was like, thank you, God.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He's just very good at that role, I feel.
But he was here, he is, I've never seen him so detestable.
This is true.
Like,
this
there's that true. Moment when he's like, oh, it's funny, my key just broke off in that lock. You're really disappointed that Peter Weller doesn't have anything to counter that. Like,
you're disappointed the gun doesn't come out and he like spins it around like fucking Murphy and shoots this guy in the head, because that would be fucking cool.
Oh, that was the moment where I honestly thought where the movie was going was I thought Peter Weller was going to be the, well, good thing I brought a key. Like, I thought it was going to be that counter of like, oh, hey, he knew what was going to happen. How cool is that? It's like, no, we've set this up so that he can come back and break into the police station later.
And the reason he's doing that is because talk about Chekhov's ghetto blaster. They established this boombox in the first 5 seconds of the movie.
I think that's what it's called from here on out.
Chekhov's ghetto blaster. So it's playing rap music. The undercover cop who's dirty shows up is like,
no, it's not. No, that's the beauty of it. It's playing like what sounds like very early.
It's bad rap, but it's definitely rap.
No, it sounds like it's very early Chili Peppers. Like, I swear to God, that's like 86, 87 Chili Peppers.
Again, I feel like we're
it's like rock music
bit.
Where it's the early you wouldn't call Chili Peppers rap, and that's what I thought was funny about the movie. He's like, can you turn that up? I hate rap music, and I'm like sitting there going, it sounds like the fucking Chili Peppers before they broke.
I disagree. It sounds like a really terrible cover of The Message by Grandmaster Flash, because it's all about, like, you can't do this, kid, because there's drugs on the street, and you can't do that because you got to get your fix. And it's just, it's like, it's a really terrible, maybe, like, thrash metal, like, cover of The Message, but the message gets across. And so, but come to find out, this boombox was also recording the whole time.
Well,
so
no. He reaches down. He says, hey,
holy shit, Cargill. You're like splitting every fucking hair tonight. Well, no. He pushes record and then it records.
Yeah. Well, that's the major plot point is he goes, hey, will you shut that music off? And he goes, yeah, sure. And hits record.
It was recording throughout the whole interaction was my point. Yeah. So splitting all day. I will have no fucking hairs left by the end
of this.
Don't
you defend Glickenhaus.
I'm not defending Glickenhaus. I'm shitting on you for splitting every hair. There's a difference. I will not defend Glickenhaus. I've seen The Soldier.
I'll split the fucking hairs, motherfucker.
Jesus Christ. Yes, this is good podcasting when we grind every detail to a halt. Anyway.
There's not a lot to this movie, dude.
201 episodes.
201 episodes. And there's not a lot to say about Shakedown. Let's
I
be
disagree.
Honest.
I'm going to say everything about Shakedown, because Shakedown is a brilliant movie. So, yes, it's being recorded. If they can get a hold of this tape, what's crazy about this is getting a hold of this tape in any other movie would be the smoking gun that gets all these cops arrested and the movie is over. Not Shakedown. Oh, no, sir. Oh, no, not Shakedown. Shakedown sets up that that's what's going to happen by having this crazy car chase entering in apparently the third movie.
Yes, where all of a sudden when we need to get to the courthouse with this evidence, we end up getting into a cab that is run by a zany comedy immigrant.
Not since Lotka on Taxi has a foreign cab driver provided this many yucks on screen.
And
holy
the thing
shit.
Is that this is why I argue that there's a third movie here, is this movie's not a comedy. Like, no. This is not a, like, this is a, like, what we haven't gotten into yet is, because what I keep trying to get to is, while all of this is going on, while you have a cop who's dealing with corruption in the NYPD, and you've got a district attorney, but a public defender dealing with corruption in the NYPD, you have a district attorney who is fucking our public defender, because they used to be in love. They broke up. Now he's off with another girl. Her dad is rich and getting him in as a lawyer at a Wall Street firm. He is hitting the big time, but you kind of want to fuck the old girlfriend for old time's sake.
It's a Faustian story.
And it starts getting weird where, like, again, in true Glickenhaus fashion, just kind of goes off the rails and, like, oh, so now this woman not only is a district attorney who has an apartment with a view of Central Park, but also has a balcony all to herself where she could just kind of go and hang out on the rooftop and look over Central Park and have meaningful conversations about, are you going to tell your girlfriend or not? And so it becomes this inner turmoil of, is RoboCop going to leave his fiance for his ex-girlfriend?
Well, again, like RoboCop, this is a Faustian story about losing your soul, because what this lawyer is actually trying to decide is whether, and again is a setup by John C. McGinley, is whether he's going to continue to do the work that is for the good of the people, or if he's going to sell out and take the high paycheck job that, you know, the new father-in-law is going. I mean, he wrestles with this throughout the movie.
Yeah.
In really stupid ways.
Yes.
And that's what I love about it. He wrestles with it for things like, she thinks Hendrix is heavy metal. What the fuck? What am I doing here?
It's too early for heavy metal. Honey, this is Hendrix. Like, in fact, that was the thing where that came out, and my wife immediately snapped up in bed and said, Hendrix isn't heavy metal. Like, honey.
Wait for it.
And then she was like, okay, the movie knows that it's not heavy metal.
It's not a comedy, but there are moments that I feel like in any other movie would be played for laughs. Case in point, when he goes to tell his fiance, we can't be together anymore because I'm in love with this woman that I was in love with before, and he doesn't get it out because she says, I'm pregnant. And his reaction is basically the sitcom of, hubba, hubba, hubba. And it's like, what fucking movie am I watching?
By the way, we get a small aside after the fact to say, oh, by the way, the rabbit never died. I just was afraid of losing you. Where it's like, oh, shit. The girlfriend knew this whole time. Like, this is pure Glickenhaus of, like, hey, here's an important plot point that I didn't bother to set up. But, yeah, she totally knew the whole time.
Yeah, she's kind of the worst. And she's, again, a carryover from last week's episode. Fucking white people. She just, the circles.
This is a movie that has that fucking white people attitude of 1988. Of, like, Jesus Christ, rich white people.
Yeah.
You are kind of the worst.
I would rather be hanging out at a prison defending. Okay, it's not a comedy, is going to be a common theme, but I just keep thinking of scenes that I feel like they wanted us to laugh at.
Yeah.
One of which, and maybe you can explain this to me as...
Old Man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
Tonight I'm splitting hairs, so we'll see.
Yeah, splitting gray hairs because you're Old Man Cargill. The thing is, there's a scene where... there's a guy pushing a cart around the prison, and this is... none of these characters have any connection to anything that happens for the rest of the movie.
But
this guy shows up, and there's two prisoners in a cell. One is a stuffed shirt white businessman. The other is a guy who looks like Carl Weathers' stunt double from Action Jackson.
His name in the 80s would have been Leroy Jenkins.
Yes, 100%.
Like, it is... Yeah, no, that is... that joke is pure 100% homophobia, my friend.
And the joke is, the guy says, would you like a book or a condom? I hate the way he says condom. It sounds like he's coughing it out, and it's so creepy. He's like, we're supposed to offer people condoms. And I'm like, okay.
Again.
Offer prisoners a condom every day. And it's like,
this is a joke about 80s liberalism. Like, this is one of those...
we're supposed to promote safe sex, and it's like, okay, get it, safe sex when people are being raped in prison. Isn't that funny? And the white guy's like, no, why would I want a condom? And the giant black dude says, I want a condom. And then it's like, I'm nervous now. And it's just like, what the fuck is this now? What is going on?
That is 80s homophobia, which was funny in the 80s. So you see, rape jokes are okay if criminals are the punchline.
And if you're not Daniel Tosh, as it turns out. That doesn't work for you, sir.
Yeah, you know what?
Let me just say
what you will. He started a very great conversation that ended very well, and a lot of people learned a lot of lessons about, oh, here's where the line on rape jokes are. And by the way, the line is still, prison rape jokes are still okay.
Yeah, and Norm MacDonald ate out on those jokes for a long time.
Yeah, he did.
I don't know why this has become us talking about stand-up comics, but...
Because that's, I mean, this is, there's a whole setup bit that not only is set up, it's the final punchline of the movie. We go back to the guy walking up and saying, do you want a book? Do you want a condom? And that's the, ha ha, we ended the movie on a gay joke.
Because once again, this is not a comedy.
It's not.
Why there are jokes, I could easily just cut that entire scene out and be just fine without it, because what's left in this movie, and what I really feel like we need to talk about,
is all the good stuff.
Is all the good stuff.
Because there's a lot of good stuff. Like, we have been kicking this movie square in the nuts
for
like half an hour now.
Well, yeah, there's stuff in this movie that's troubling and I wish wasn't there. But even beyond that, the bad stuff in this movie is still glorious. It's still amazing to watch. It still upholds all of the junk food core values.
So let's go back to where we ended up getting sidetracked for a while. So there's a moment in which bad cop hires bad dude to kill our cop.
So Sergeant Hockey Hair hires Huggy Bear to kill Sam Elliott.
Captain Texas Mullet.
Captain Texas Mullet. Because he will not play ball, and it's very obvious he's literally the one cop in New York City who won't play ball.
He can't be bought.
Can't be bought.
Which is being evidenced by the fact that he's so poor that he's living in a 42nd Street theater and brushing his teeth, you know, in this fucking place that looks like the aftermath after Demons. it is in a bad way, dude. And so he's out fishing in the Hudson. Because that's what a Texan does.
Because he wants to catch a corpse.
Yeah. And he's walking back, and this guy, who's clearly there to try to kill him, is distracting him while someone sneaks up behind him. Sam Elliott's all over this, like, right away, because Sam Elliott is psychic cop.
And then he throws the rod at one guy and hits the other guy with a bucket, because someday you get the rod and someday you get the pail. I assume is what he was thinking.
Probably. And then, you know, he does this great thing where he cuffs one guy to the bars.
To the railing.
And then throws him over it. So he's literally hanging there. I'm like, okay, that's pretty fucking cool. And then chases after the guy. Well, the guy gets into your typical 80s, I'm a bad guy and have completely lost my mind chase scene where, oh God, a cop is chasing me. So instead of being smart and ducking off to the side somewhere and hiding, I'm going to grab this random woman and hold a gun to her head because I've completely lost all sense of rationality.
Yeah, he's especially dumb because he runs into a crowded amusement park, which would be the perfect place for cover and to hide and get away. And the first thing he does, he fires up in the air so everyone else lays down.
Yeah. And so
that Sam Elliott has a better view of exactly where he is.
And so it turns into a gunfight. They run. They end up wrestling around on an empty roller coaster. The roller coaster takes off. They're headed up. The guy gets the better of Sam Elliott, throws him out of the roller coaster. Sam Elliott grabs onto the back of the roller coaster, reaches in, pulls a couple of wires. A little sparks fly, and he lets go. And the guy's like, fuck you, cop. And Sam Elliott just famously says, no, fuck you.
No, actually, it's fuck you, asshole.
And so then the roller coaster literally goes off the rails.
What I find funny about that scene is that it doesn't go off the rails for about 15 seconds. And for those 15 seconds, it's just doing what the roller coaster is supposed to be doing. But the guy still looks worried. And I'm like, at this point, you don't know anything is wrong because it's just a roller coaster.
I was actually fine with that because he's not strapped in. He's literally on the top of the roller coaster. Like, I was just waiting for it to go around a corner too fast and throw his body off. Oh no.
Glickenhaus is not happy with that.
Glickenhaus was not satisfied with that. The entire roller coaster breaks through the side, goes off the rails, breaks to the side, flies out into a fucking taco stand.
Yeah.
Fucking flattening it, killing God knows how many people inside.
The collateral damage is hilarious.
And kills the dude. And so we get some roller coaster foo in there.
Which you think is, I mean, at this point, not even the craziest stunt work that we've seen. There's a scene right before this where they're at some kind of weird Eyes Wide Shut club on 42nd Street where one of the informants has been electrocuted while handcuffed to a bed. And then the bad guy is wearing a robe. He looks like Black Oddjob. I mean, that's the look he's going for,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And he throws knives out of his sleeves to kill two cops. And then these guns that are on some kind of like metal rigging device pop up and he starts shooting people on the sidewalk. Sam Elliott jumps out of a window onto the biggest fucking streetlight I've ever seen in my life.
It is one of those moments that is about it. in a bigger movie, that would be an iconic stunt moment. Like, that is that. This is what stunts in the 80s felt like, where you've got an actor hanging on a streetlight that starts bending over and snapping down and dropping him onto the street, where he then drops on top of a bus and rolls off and assaults a guy to steal his motorcycle.
And then Peter Weller jumps in the... It's interesting. I haven't really seen a motorcycle configured like this before, because normally when I see motorcycles with sidecars, they're literally off to the side of the motorcycle.
Oh, yeah. This is a three-wheeler. This is a three-wheeler motorcycle.
With a seat in the back.
But they exist. Yeah.
So the two of them, Peter Weller brandishing a gun a lot in this movie, despite the fact that we've established he's a lawyer. He is a public defender who is just super comfortable shooting people, and nobody seems to care.
Nobody seems to care. And then they start the running joke. Do you want to drive or you want to shoot?
Yes.
Which we will get in the blistering climax to this film.
But that's acknowledging a trope, and I actually do like that joke, because that is something you see in buddy cop movies a lot.
I do too. I'm not bitching about it. I'm saying they're setting up the bug fuck nuts last 5 minutes of this movie, because this movie goes so off the rails in the last 5 minutes. You're like, oh, the movie's done. Oh, no, it's not.
See, and I feel like another running theme of this movie is, in any other movie, that would be the end of it. But Glickenhaus is not satisfied with that. Case in point, this chase that ends with the bad guy's car flipping upside down, flying off the edge of a, like, the bridge is out in speed, kind of, like, end of the highway. It lands top down, and you're like, it's either going to explode or he's just dead. But then the guy gets out of the car, and Sam Elliott, who has flipped over the chain link fence that the car knocked over as it went off the edge, is hanging onto the chain link fence, reaches down and shoots the motorcycle leaking gasoline, which makes the car explode. It's just like, fuck me, this is a stuntman's paradise.
Yeah, it goes way over the top in terms of every action stunt feels like, again, like it's not for this movie.
Not at all.
Like, this feels like it should be a Joel Silver movie, and it's really not. And you also, if you want to compare and contrast how to make a good Joel Silver-style movie and how to make a bad one, this and Action Jackson are pretty much the way to do it. Because as batshit crazy as all the action scenes in Action Jackson are,
they're in the same movie.
They're in the same movie, and you know what movie that is, and you know why they're doing it. Like, it feels like, oh, yes, this is why they're making this movie.
Instead, this is like if Bad Boys 2 came crashing through the window of And Justice for All.
Yes.
What the fuck is... I love this movie!
I know you do.
Why does this exist except for my pleasure? Like, I...
So let's get into it, because we really need to get into it. So we get to the end of this fucking movie, and the DA has made the plea, our public defender has made his plea. He's laid it out, and the jury comes back not guilty.
Well, before that, they get, like, again, Cargill mentioned this zany cab driver in his own third movie, who they're running from dirty cops, and by that I mean the entire police force.
Yeah, so... So they
literally running from the entire police force.
He breaks into the police station, he gets caught doing it, because it's the dumbest plan ever.
He's not a cop, he's a lawyer.
They start to play Russian roulette with him. They're clearly going to kill him. All hell breaks loose, and Sam Elliott shows up. It's like, oh yeah, Sam Elliott's in this movie again. Can we just quick pause.
You're going to pause now. I want to talk about how filthy James Glickenhaus thinks New York is. Like, I'm not even going to mention the fact that during the scene where Sam Elliott's walking out of the 42nd Street Theater, we literally see a guy sweeping up needles, just piles of needles from the theater floor. Okay, fine. This is a New York City in Glickenhaus's mind where the evidence room of a New York City police precinct doubles as the murder room, where they have tarp already up on the walls ready to blow this guy's brains out. What the fuck kind of Mad Max dystopia is James Glickenhaus living in his mind?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this many times. Like, this has been one of the big running themes of junk food cinema.
Is who's going to drive and who's going to shoot.
Yes. Is that in the 80s, New York City was disintegrating. And it was disintegrating rapidly to the point that we have a lot of movies that we've talked about in this podcast that have taken real locations and used them for post-apocalyptic sets because they existed. Buildings collapsed and nobody bothered to clean them up because there's no money in it. Like, it was, you know, it is very much, it's all tied back into what happened with The Long Good Friday, where you had a bunch of people going, hey, look, here's this area where it's really cheap. If we put several years of development into this, we could actually end up making a shit ton of money. And that finally happened in New York. And as we talked about, Giuliani took over. He brought in some draconian police procedures. You know, they became a much more corporate city. And here we are 30 years later, and it is cleaned up, and people are complaining that only the rich can live there. It is a rapid turnaround. But at this time, that is what people thought about New York City. New York City was the end of society. New York City was everything wrong with America in one 8 million person city.
And I feel like there is a certain amount of truth to that. I mean, the fact that apparently Peter Weller and Sam Elliott both had to have bodyguards with them 24/7 whenever they shot in Times Square because it was that dicey. I get that, but like, that is next level shit when everybody in the precinct is so corrupt that they're literally just ready to kill you right there next to the evidence locker. Like, that's fucking crazy.
Kind of. I mean, that's you know, the main bad guy wants to do it, and the other cops aren't totally cool with this. There's that moment
But it's definitely set up and ready to go.
It is, yeah, but they were kind of like, wait a second, wait, you want us to murder this guy? Like, we're bad cops.
But Sergeant Hockey Hair, how will we get away with that
one? Like, breaking off a key in the evidence locker so that we can put away a cop killer is one thing. Actually blowing the public defender's head off is another. I don't know about that.
They still look pretty primed for it.
Yeah, no, but they're, yes, everyone is dirty. In fact, that's one of the great moments in this movie where this cop shows up to actually take a trip to the literal sidebar for a second. One of the best parts of this movie is where Peter Weller sits down next to Sam Elliott and says, I'll have two of whatever he's having. You want a quadruple Boilermaker? And I'm like, that's a Cargill drink if ever I've heard one. Jesus Christ.
I feel like we need to try that sometime.
Four shots of whiskey and a beer. That's what we call the... If that's not the junk food pairing, if we don't call it the shakedown, at the end of the shakedown, I have no idea what we're doing with our lives. But so that's the best moment in the movie. But one of the best moments in the movie is where he's, you know, Sam Elliott once again in a bar, and then this baby-faced cop comes in and sits down next to him and tells him about this bit of evidence. And he's like, hey, I was the first cop on the scene. He's like, why are you doing this? And he's like, well, my brother was one of the cops that died in that chase. And so one of the cops killed in this scene that you were talking about, throwing the knives out or shooting out the things, whatever that was.
Both of those things happened.
One of those cops was the cop that was a cop that was the brother of this cop. And Sam Elliott, of course, killed the guy that killed his brother. So this guy is willing to like give this evidence. And Sam Elliott says, you know, a lot of dirty cops are going to fucking burn. You're going to burn this whole department down. He goes, yeah, I know. And that's this really great moment in this movie where there's a great character bit where that, and this is something I've never seen in a movie like this, where this thing, you know, running down one of the bad guys and killing one of the bad guys ends up resulting in a major plot point of somebody coming forward and going, hey, yeah, that guy you killed. Yeah, that dude killed my brother. You were chasing him because he killed my brother. And so I'm going to make this huge sacrifice because that's what my brother would want. Like, there's this great, great emotional moment in this small scene for a character whose movie this really isn't.
And I love the character beat with Elliot of him saying, I mean, him basically trying to make this guy understand the ramifications, even though it's everything Sam Elliott wants to hear and needs to know.
He's like, he's like, what's going to happen.
You're aware of what I'm going to do with this, right?
And he's like, yeah. And it's so that moment is worth the rest of the movie. Like, in terms of what that moment does for the characters, and it's just, it's something really great that you don't see in this kind of movie, because the problem with this kind of movie, and what part of what we love about this kind of movie, is that you have these cops doing this ultra violence and getting this revenge, and there's no ramifications for it because death doesn't fucking matter in these movies.
Yeah.
Like, that's the whole thing, is that it just doesn't fucking matter. Like, we just watched a guy go off the rails on a roller coaster in a thing that would get a park shut down.
I kind of feel like that park should have been shut down anyway.
Yeah.
It looks like a rustier Coney Island.
I think that's exactly what it was actually a rusty Coney Island.
Which, by the way, cost a lot of money with the prostitute.
But
to get the rusty Coney Island.
Rusty Coney Island?
Yep.
Yeah. I've had that. It's the all night where you're being chased by a bunch of other dudes.
Yeah.
Just to get to Coney Island. So
you got to drink 4 Boilermakers to have enough bottles to do the come and play.
So, yeah. But no, it's the type of death that you'd read about in the paper. Like a man died on a roller coaster that went on the rails and then be like, oh, did you hear about the guy on the
fucking
roller?
Jay Leno will be doing jokes about it all week.
He would. But it was like, but death, you know, that kind of death in this movie doesn't fucking matter. And here's this moment where this actual murder carries weight in the plot. And it's like, well, that's refreshing. And then it goes away because then we finally get into, you know, RoboCop Escapes.
And which is my favorite unproduced sequel.
Yeah. And he gets into a cab driven by the guy who drives around Deadpool, apparently. And he's like, I'm an immigrant. I have just passed my... I've taken the test. I passed my
residency.
Citizenship.
Citizenship. Yeah,
I know that that's illegal and unconstitutional.
What they're
so
doing.
I'm going to help. What they're doing. I'm going to help you. Also, one of the things I love about the '80s that doesn't get enough play, that I think of all the things from the '80s really could use a resurgence, is '80s cinema love of immigrants. Mm-hmm. Like, this is one of those things where the good guy is here. He's a guy from another country who's come here to be American and knows what it is to be American and is fucking laying it out for the good guy. And it's like, it's such a cool moment. And it's a moment that's very much like what it was about the 80s. Like, the 80s loved, it was, had finally embraced all the racism that was against immigrants for a long time. And had finally been like, hey, you know what? Immigrants are just people from around the world that just want to be American. And we kind of love that. Like, there's nothing more American than wanting to be American. So, yeah. And this whole moment is about that. And then we get this car chase with this zany cabbie.
Let's talk about that car chase.
Let's talk about it for a moment.
I just want to say it one more time. This is not a comedy. And yet, this car chase ends with literally a crane picking up the cab and carrying it over a wall of police officers so that it lands in another wall of police officers
that then pull out guns.
Then the judge comes out of the courthouse, apparently having heard the commotion, decides to come out of the courthouse, and he's like, I have evidence. And the cops are like, we're about to arrest this man. And she says something that, one, I don't know if it's true. And two, even if it is true, it's not true in this movie. She says, on the street, you are the law. On the steps of this courthouse, I rule. I don't know if that's true, for one. And two, they are abso-fucking-lutely not on the steps of that courthouse.
They really are.
They're like half a mile away from that courthouse.
Like, you could see it, like, it's a matte painting in the background.
Yeah.
Like, on the steps of this matte painting,
I rule.
The
steps of that courthouse, way the fuck back there, I rule. So put your guns down and you'll be arrested for obstruction. In any other movie, that would be the end.
But in this movie, the bailiff.
Not again. And in any other movie, the bailiff does the whole, like, make my day line. Isn't it funny? Whatever. That would be the end of it. They have the crucial evidence.
Pulls out a gun and holds it to a cop's head.
Yes.
Like, this is how nutty this movie fucking gets.
So much effort in the service of getting this piece of evidence into the judge's hand. And then she says, I can't admit this as evidence.
Yep.
And I'm like, what the fuck was the point of all of that?
Nothing.
That's amazing.
Because now what the point of that is he had it. We as the audience know the truth. Because that's the thing, is up until this point in the movie, we've been led to believe the truth that this guy was a dirty cop, what they call a blue jeans cop. What Sam Elliott explains is, giving a speech about what a blue jeans cop is.
I wear Wranglers and they wear Sergio Valente. By the way, Sam Elliott saying Sergio Valente.
Kind of amazing.
Put the nitro back in the box. I'm getting a little bit of a stiffy over here.
Getting a little misty.
Woo!
A little bit of pre-cum there, my friend.
I said one thing,
Sergio Valente,
and you took it one step further. You know why? Because you're like James Glickenhouse.
I'm like
most
James
people would be satisfied with the illusion, the nitro in the box. But no, you went full pre-cum.
I went full pre-cum because we're...
Sorry, Mom. I'm so sorry. Anyway, so
we are located squarely in Finger Bang City.
This movie should have been called Finger Bang City.
So now we have to fucking, like, Peter Weller has to go all out and fucking defend and give the closing argument of a lifetime.
So the assumption is that he wins based on just the power of his lawyering because he didn't have this crucial piece of evidence.
But we do know now because we heard on the tape, we listen to the tape, and the story happens exactly as the drug dealer tells it. Because in the beginning of the movie, we get the beginning of it, and then it cuts away, and then we see the aftermath.
You know, that's interesting.
And the whole movie, we believe this guy because our DA believes him. We don't actually have a reason to fully believe him, but we see these corrupt cops. We want to believe the cops are corrupt. We want to believe that this guy was just defending himself, and we want to believe our DA is right. And then we get the information that, hey, by the way, he was right all along. This cop was dirty and did exactly, it went down exactly. This criminal didn't lie about a goddamn word about what happened.
See, I never even thought to question it because, one, the movie does such a great job of establishing that we are in the ninth circle of hell where all the cops are out to get us. And two, why would I not trust Peter Weller? A guy who literally is on his way out the door but still feels strongly enough about this case as his last day as a public defender to take on something as arduous as defending a cop killer. Like, I had no reason in my brain to doubt it. But I understand what you're saying. That is probably the reason why it's in there. But it just never struck me that the guy could have been lying.
Yeah,
in the first place.
That's the thing is, up until that point in the movie, you actually, as the audience member, don't know. You just believe. Mm-hmm. Like, we didn't see it. That element would be used a couple of years later in Esther House's movie, Basic Instinct, that where you see a murder at the beginning of the movie.
Verhoeven.
Esther House wrote it. Verhoeven directed it.
Gotcha.
Yeah, sorry, I was referencing...
You're saying too many foreign names.
but Esther House is American as fuck. But it would be used in Basic Instinct where we would actually see the murder and then by the end of the movie be convinced that it didn't happen. Like, that's the magic of Basic Instinct was that by the end of the movie, you've so bought into her bullshit that you believe that what you saw at the beginning of the movie was a lie.
Yeah.
And this is kind of that where they're playing around with that whole, hey, we're believing the bad guy, you know, and we're buying into it. But then we find out, hey, by the way, they were right all along. They had it. This cop really was a bad cop. So we then win the court case and the movie's over, right, Brian?
No.
Let's close this up.
No.
What's the junk food pairing of the week?
No, because I am James Glickenhouse and I am not satisfied. I am not yet satisfied. I demand satisfaction.
What could possibly happen after the plot of our movie is done and the guy has gotten off?
I feel like we need one more action sequence where not only does it outdo all of the other action sequences, but it accidentally also predicts 9/11. That is the only fitting way I feel to end this movie. And it does, in fact, end with another, do you want to drive or do you want to shoot, where they're literally chasing down
on
the runway.
Hold on. No. Sam Elliott shows up in the stolen Porsche of the police officer who was murdered.
This is correct.
At the court case, just as RoboCop's walking out. And sees him there and is like, wait, what's up? Oh, by the way, the bad guys are going to the airport and they're going to fly off and we're not going to catch them. So,
because I've been doing police work in my movie off to the side.
I'm in this separate movie that when I'll show you someday. It'll be great.
it's called Blue Jean Cuffs.
And so he's like, do you want to drive or you want to shoot? And he's like, this time I want to drive. So now we're in a Porsche going to the airport. And just as the bad guys get on the plane, and I want you to remember that this is the 1980s. So when the bad guys are on a plane and the good guys are in a car, there's only one way this is going to end.
With Sam Elliott grabbing onto the landing gear of a private jet as it takes off like he's Tom goddamn Cruise in a Mission Impossible sequel. And this thing takes... And this is why I just...
So is he going to... Let me ask you, Brian. Is he going to wait for the landing gear to retract and then crawl into the airplane and then arrest them inside?
Oh, well, let me just Mr. Glickenhouse, would that satisfy? No, I am not satisfied.
Just Why does he have a grenade?
Don't worry about it.
Is it just that he has a spare grenade from earlier in the movie when he blows open a door with a grenade?
God. So he starts shooting into the fuselage to call, and then he shoots at the engine.
He's on the plane in the air over the Hudson shooting at the plane he's in.
No survival instincts whatsoever.
None.
Just like keyed in to bringing these guys down. Shoots up into the fuselage, then shoots the engine. And again, I just want to point out that this movie has a shot where a plane comes very close to hitting one of the towers of the Trade Center, and that's troubling. But then Sam Elliott figures out that they're going to have to fly over water to land again, so he throws a grenade into the fuselage of the plane and then jumps off because
he's over water. Physics.
Because then, in any other movie, any other director would have been fine with that plane getting grounded, the cops getting arrested, Huggy Bear getting arrested. But no, this is the plane lands, beat, 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 explosion. And that's how you end the fucking movie.
That's not how you end the movie, because now Peter Weller is walking out to the Hudson.
Yeah.
And we see Sam Elliott swimming in.
Sam Elliott should be covered in needles, by the way. He should look like fucking Hellraiser.
He just dropped like 500 feet off of a plane into the Hudson. He's fine. He's just fine. Swimming out. And then we have the happy buddy comedy cop moment of the end of the movie, and now the movie's fucking over.
We think this movie is like a tantric action flick. Like, it just does not climax.
Or a slowdown sting.
You keep waiting and waiting and waiting for this thing to peak, and it's like, is it ever gonna happen? I have no idea. By the way, I want to mention, there's a reason that this is Glickenhaus's most polished movie, and it still looks like this. It's because originally it was going to be released by Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh, yeah. It's a De Laurentiis film.
And then, before the movie came out, De Laurentiis Group folded like warm laundry. And so Universal picked it up. So the only reason that Glickenhaus has a movie with this kind of polish on it that was a big studio movie is because the studio that was going to release his movie fell apart before it came out.
Oddly enough, a weird tie-in, this month's Deep Dish is also a 1988 De Laurentiis follow.
A casualty? It's a casualty?
A casualty of the De Laurentiis. Yeah. So, shakedown in this movie. So now we have ties to three of these two films tie into our deep dish this month. And it's going to be delightful when you guys finally find out what the fuck this thing is.
I also think my favorite marquee on 42nd Street in this movie is Whoopi Goldberg in Fatal Beauty.
Oh, yeah.
Which also starred Sam Elliott. So, you know, lots of... This is an incredible... Guys, this is a you have to see this movie to believe it exists. Because us describing it sounds like we're out of our goddamn minds. Or that the scotch has gone bad and we're, you know, losing it. Like, no. This is a real movie that exists. And it exists in a plane of being that I felt like I was the only person populating until I saw this film and realized, oh no, they still make movies for people on exactly this wavelength, and I am so happy it exists, and I'm so happy it's the movie we're using to wrap up Summer of 88, because next week we move into Summer of 78.
Yeah, we're closing out the summer. It was a tough call. Like, we'd done 86, 87, and it was like, well, we got to do 88. But we kind of wanted to do Summer of 78 because, dear God, the classics that came out in 78.
There's some cool shit.
So from here on out, August and into early September, we're going to be talking about some of the very best movies of 1978 that, hey, by the way, also you probably fucking love.
Very, very true. And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. We have, I think, two rivaling that are on the exact same idea. One, of course, being the quadruple Boilermaker, which you've called a shakedown. I would argue that Peter Weller, in the first 5 minutes of this movie, invents the actual shakedown.
Oh.
The homemade
Orange Julius.
The homemade Orange Julius, which is milk,
Orange juice,
and just a smattering of Maxwell House coffee, and then a raw egg.
This is not Maxwell House coffee.
Except that it absolutely says Maxwell House coffee on the side of it.
It's the 1980s Maxwell House instant coffee. Like, this is the... These are crystals. This is not just, like, grounds of coffee. And, no. No, I think this is important.
No, sure, absolutely. It's an important distinction.
Have you ever had instant coffee, out of curiosity?
No, I don't drink coffee.
I know. This is why there's a difference. Like, you can make chocolate-covered coffee beans and eat a coffee bean. Mm-hmm. Coffee beans, when roasted right, are delicious eating it. Grinding them up, you can eat coffee grounds. If you don't filter your coffee properly, you'll end up with coffee grounds in it. Totally fine, because some people enjoy the flavor. Instant coffee are these weird crystals that when they hit water, instantly vaporize and turn into coffee. Like, it is a horrible thing from the 70s and 80s of, hey, let's put a spoonful of this into boiling water and turn it into coffee. It is awful, awful stuff by the best standards. And that's what he's throwing into this Orange Julius thing, which makes it even grosser. It's not even a little bit of coffee grounds in there. It's this terrible instant fucking coffee.
And make sure to toss a raw egg on top and blend it all up while you're listening to Hendrix, because I feel like that's what he's actually created, is a shakedown.
And he's arguing that it's homemade Orange Julius, which, by the way, hold on.
Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
Orange Julius was the creme de la creme of mall drinks. In the 80s, like, you could not go to a mall that did not have an Orange Julius. And the Orange Julius was almost always next to hot dog on a stick, which was best known for hiring really attractive girls and putting them in the ugliest outfits ever invented by man.
Can I just, Jürgen, pause now? Isn't a hot dog on a stick just a corn dog?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Just wanted to make sure.
It's just a corn dog, but the place is called Hot Dog on a Stick. And the reason, and I found this out, I was always curious why they had all these attractive girls at Hot Dog and a Stick, and why they would all work there, and why they would wear this terrible outfit. And apparently the whole big thing of it in the 80s was they had a bunch of hot dogs on a stick all throughout California. And the big thing was you would go and you would work at Hot Dog on a Stick, and then during the summer, they would you would be sent to go and work at a hot dog on a stick somewhere in California, and they would pay your room and board. And so you worked this shitty minimum wage job and then got a free trip to California out of it.
I love that we are unraveling the conspiracy of Hot Dog on a Stick on this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, but that was the other thing, was they were, it was because it was the 80s and there's still, you know, we had not quite reached equality yet. Hiring just women for a job was a thing that you could still, for that kind of a job, was still a thing you could totally do. But it was that and Orange Julius. And so Orange Julius was kind of this hip thing. So for him to say, oh, I'm making homemade Orange Julius, is like, oh, I see what you think you're doing there. It's still fucking gross as shit.
I don't remember coffee being an ingredient of Orange Julius.
I don't either, but apparently instant coffee, like these coffee... Dude, instant coffee is it sends me into spasms.
No, clearly.
Like, it's a thing that if you've ever, like, you know, been at a place, like, because it was very popular, like, at summer camps and things like that, where it was, hey, we're going to have this around because we're going to go out and camp at night, and then we're going to boil some water and throw some coffee grounds in it. And it's like, those aren't coffee grounds, that's instant crystals. And it's like, I know, it's even better. And it's like, no, it's disgusting. Why are you putting these things in food? This is... And fortunately, it's not a popular enough thing anymore.
No, it's clearly something that sticks in your craw.
I have issues with this.
I knew it was stuck in your craw because you stopped the show for a fourth time to correct me. You know what? We're changing the name of the movie. It's now just called Shutdown.
Shutdown.
Shutdown is the new name of this movie.
Like, you know, if you get the details right of the movie, I don't have to correct you.
Then stop making me do the plot synopsis, asshole. Do it yourself. God, I'm going to make a homemade Orange Julius and make you drink it.
Oh, fuck.
That's what's going
to
happen.
I'm going to end up on one of my diets again the week you show up to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's going to matter. Anyway, Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Not drinking coffee crystals, I'll tell you that much. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massaworm, MassaWyrm. And my new book, We Are Where the Nightmares Go, is in bookstores and wherever you buy books.
Nice. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. And of course, you can find this Podcast on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show,
I mean really like the show,
if you like the show as much as Cargill hates Folgers crystals,
if you like the show as much as I enjoy correcting Brian,
Jesus Christ, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema for as little as $1 an episode. You might get me to a place financially where I no longer have to subject myself to this, but probably not. Anyway, guys, thank you so much for joining us for this, the last movie. Do we want to... I guess we haven't really figured out what our first movie of 78 is going to be. I know one we're definitely going to cover is the best film Jeanette Zwark ever directed, that happens to be the sequel to a very classic piece of cinema that gets shit on because it's a part two, but is in fact really cool. So
we talked about the one where a shark is a slasher?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
we're talking about Jaws 2?
We are talking about Jaws 2.
I think it might be a little college movie thrown in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah. It's American Sharkfeedy. There's a lot going on with Jaws 2.
78 was an amazing fucking summer, and we've got some really exciting stuff to talk about. We don't spend enough time in the 70s. We often, live in the 80s, but we're gonna spend a little time in 78 and talk about some stuff you love and stuff you should love.
I agree. So we're going to end this episode, and guys, I know what you're thinking. I'm young and quick, and Cargill's old and slow. Well, no, actually, that's pretty accurate.